Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. We're doing the second part, but we're going to start at the beginning and read through so we have our background. Okay. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, Arise, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. And the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. And it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, his hair and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were burning fire, and a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. And all the peoples, nations, and men of every language, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. This is kind of key because then you don't have to keep on guessing what does all this mean. And the other thing is you end up finding out what details of the vision are important. When he gives you the details, he's kind of highlighting what things are important in the vision. And then if you're wondering, well, I wonder what color the paws are, you kind of realize, oh, it doesn't matter. Okay? The significant things are going to be related. There we go. So, these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. There's your complete summary. That's the summary of world history for the last several thousand years, and we're still in the middle of it. Isn't that great? Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, and its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High, and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alteration in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. Okay, so we worked our way through to the first part, and let's do a little bit of a review. Let's open up in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for this great passage. It is a very important passage. From this, we begin to realize how even to interpret a whole host of other passages that are yet to come. And then this becomes a very much a prophetic key to figuring out how we should tackle prophecy. So, Lord, I would pray you'd help us to apply our minds to it, that your Holy Spirit would enable us to understand it. Help me to teach it with clarity so that at the end of the day we will understand our time is short. We need to live holy and upright lives, and that we need to be going out into the highways and buying and highways and byways and compelling people to come in and being fearless in our proclamation of truth. Help us to have that as the outcome of our study of prophecy, we pray. In the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Mm-hmm. Okay. If I were to sit down there, I'm having a real back and shoulder problem. If I sat down there, would it be something, could we try that for just a bit and see if you can still hear and see and all of that? Okay. So if I'm here, is everybody still in on the deal?
Yeah. Why don't we just all sit on couches down here? More people can
come. They'll probably want to take a surface.
Yeah, some people want to take notes. Okay, so there we go. If you're okay, is it working?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so why don't we do a little bit of a quiz here? So the four animals refer to what? Anybody?
Kingdoms.
Do we already know what the kingdoms are?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What are the kingdoms? Somebody help us.
Babylon.
The first one is Babylon. And that was the one that was the first animal that was referred to. And that was a lion with the wings, with wings on it. How do we know that that was Babylon? What's that?
Dwight said something.
It was gold.
It's gold.
If Daniel straight up said it was.
Yeah, Daniel straight up said it was. We don't have to wonder about what it was. You bet. Good deal. Okay, the second one was what?
Middle Persia.
Okay, we have a one with a bear and has three ribs in its mouth. Okay, and do we know what that one is? Yes, we do, because we already know in the book of Daniel, that's already been made clear. So, and that, the second kingdom was whom?
Persia.
Medo-Persia, you bet. The third one was going to be coming along, and that was a leopard. Do we know now what that third kingdom, or that third empire was?
Yes.
Greece. No, Greece, okay. Do we already know what the four heads were all about?
Four generals.
That's right, four generals. It just really, really clear. And then there is this beast. Most of them, you know, were either a bear or a leopard or whatever. This one is so horrible that it isn't even given any kind of a likeness. So it's not like a platypus or not like a whatever. It's just understood to be a horrible critter. And it does a lot of trampling, okay? So, how are we going to find out what that means? Well, as we go through the chapter, it actually tells us, doesn't it? And what was the empire that came in and utterly took over from Greece? Okay, and what is the world empire that takes over from Rome?
Rome
hasn't fallen.
Christ.
Oh, Christ.
So, in its ultimate, in its last stage, Christ comes back with his saints, and he utterly destroys Rome. Okay? So, has Christ come back yet?
No.
Doesn't seem like it, no.
Hopefully not.
Right? And we know that Jesus, when he was talking about things, he was saying, you know, when I come again, you will see me coming on the clouds and so forth. We'll look at that. So this is something that is yet future for us. And so the empire, the world empire that takes over after Rome is going to be the empire of Christ. So, but let's pick it up. Let's start in verse 9. He said, I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Any ideas of how we're going to tackle what is the word ancient, or who is it referring to, the Ancient of Days?
Did we not figure that was Christ?
Well, it's okay, so capitalized, would that have been capitalized in the Hebrew?
No.
Okay, all right. So when you do see, just so that you know, when you do see something capitalized, what should we interpret from that?
It's important. No, sorry.
Yes, you're right. No problem. It's important. Yeah.
Person, place, or thing.
Just that.
A noun. That would fit with our common usage in the English. But when you see something capitalized like that, you understand that is the interpretation of the translator. Okay, because there were no capitals. There was a family of copies of the New Testament that were all capitals because they wrote in all capital letters, and but the originals were all written in minuscules or in what do you call non-capital?
Lowercase.
There you go. But the first 150, 200 years were all they're all minuscules, and then they came the ones that were all capitalized. Okay. So, Ancient of Days. Looking at verses 9 to 14, tell me what you can come up with being, you know, in terms of exposition here about the characteristic or the identity of the Ancient of Days.
White as snow, pure.
Okay, so his garments are very white, his hair is very white.
I'm thinking, so I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat, so...
So it's a throne.
Throne.
Okay.
For the Ancient of Days.
Okay, so where are we understanding that this is taking place? Any clues?
Judgment.
Okay, so this is a judgment seat. How do we know that this isn't Washington, D.C.?
The throne was ablaze with flames.
Yeah, okay. So whoever it is, he's sitting on a throne that's blazing with flames, and we're not calling in the paramedics, okay? So this is something a little different. Okay, so this is something supernatural. What else can we find out about the Ancient of Days?
It says in 14 that he gave, the Son of Man came and he gave him dominion and everything. So that'd be describing the Father giving.
Yeah, okay. So whoever this is, he has dominion to give, okay? I heard on the news you can now buy real estate in Mars.
Wow.
And I'm just wondering, okay, so who actually has the authority? Who actually, can give you a genuine deeded certificate to a chunk of property in Mars? Okay. Because they don't own it, okay? So it's not worth the paper it's written on. But here, whoever this is who's sitting on the throne, he has the authority to give basically the title deed, dominion, and he has the authority to do that everlastingly. What else can we pick up from that passage? In terms of the relation of other beings to him.
10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were open.
Okay, so there's a lot of people standing before him. And why are they standing before him?
They're about to be judged. The books were open.
Read on. Let's find out why are they standing before him.
I watched them because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking.
Let's go back to 10 about the one standing before him.
Fiery steam issued and came forth from before him, 1,000,000s ministered to him.
What's that talking about?
Lots of people ministering to him.
Okay.
Angels.
Okay. So, Tammy, for example, how many angels do you normally keep around on a weekend to look after you? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so is there any doubt that this is God the Father? Okay, and it's funny because there's endless debate on this, and there shouldn't be endless debate. There's endless debate because the term Ancient of Days is used a grand total of 3 times all in this passage. Okay, however, that doesn't mean that we don't have other intimations as to who this would be. Would someone read for us Genesis chapter 21, verse 33? Genesis chapter 21, verse 33.
Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God.
The El Olam, meaning the God who always was, always will be. Very interesting term, but, again, giving intimation to the idea of eternal generation. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. Who would read that first, please?
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
Okay. Who's that talking about?
Jesus.
Well, it says Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Is that possible?
Yep.
Can you use that term also about Christ? Yeah, you can. Okay. By the way, in case you want to know how to say that, who wants to know how to say that in the Hebrew? Ad-av. Two words. Ad. 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 Actually, that's a softer. Ad-av.
Ad-av.
Yeah, there you go. Eternal Father. Eternal Father. And the other one we looked at, the everlasting God, is El Olam, okay? El short for Elohim, so El Olam, so everlasting Father. Okay, so this is God the Father. What can we find out about the Trinity in here?
In Daniel?
Yep, in this passage from verse 9 to 14.
I was watching the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days.
Okay.
They brought him near before him.
So what are we learning about the Trinity? What things can we nail down about the Trinity out of this?
There's two of them.
There's two of them. Okay. So this is not a situation of modalism where, okay, so today I'm a plumber, so I put on my plumber hat. Today I need to be Father, so I put on my Father hat, okay? It's two people, two persons, and yet one God. Yes?
So how can they not consider this verse then? Like those that...
It was a complete mystery to them. They had no idea who this Son of Man was. It was a complete mind blower. The fact that he would be called the Son of Man, okay... It isn't when we use the term Son of Man or Son of God, it's not talking about generation. Okay, it's not talking. The specific emphasis is not generation. It's a little closer to a English colloquialism. Man, he's a son of a gun, meaning. He is an extreme gunner guy. He's an extremely proficient at using a gun, okay? Or he is the ultimate gunner. And here is, they're saying basically he is the ultimate man. And you also will see a reference to Christ, him being the Son of God, and it's just talking about ultimate God from the same thing. Wow. Again, it's not talking about origins. It's talking about he's not just God. He is the Son of God. He's the ultimate God. That's how the same term is used.
The Pharisees interpreted when he said that's true.
And now it makes a little more sense when you go to the Gospels and you see places. One of the favorite terms that Jesus referred to himself was what? Son of Man. And he'd swap that up very, very freely with Son of God. And this is the passage he's referring to. He's trying to get them all to picture this. Somebody who is fully God, but yet the ultimate man, who's standing in front of God, the Father, receiving all dominion, authority, and power. Okay? So that was very, very deliberate where Christ was using that terminology. Okay, so we can learn some things about it's not modalism is never going to be appropriate, okay? Because there's separate persons. One who is in a distinct geographic position, comes up to close proximity, something is given to him, and so forth. So it has to be the interaction between two persons. Okay, let's look a little bit further at God the Father. Do we not recognize or do we not describe him as being the invisible God? Okay, so why is he describing what he's looking like if he's invisible?
Like he's omnipresent.
What's that?
Isn't that just for our benefit so we can understand?
Okay, but do you think, so how do we take this? This is just sort of, it's figurative, it's allegorical, or is this real?
It's real.
You're going to say it's real, but he's invisible.
True, but he can take on, he can take this on, as well as, couldn't it be? Could it be the Lord? No, because we've established
it's God the Father.
God the Father, right?
Yeah.
So it could be that he just.
When it says no man has seen God at any time, does that mean that he does not have any form at all? Yes.
I'm just thinking back to when Moses said to the Israelites, he said, be careful that you did not see any image of God at the mountain.
Right.
Don't make anything. To have an idea of what God looks like, would that not be something that would be warned against also?
Yes. Okay. But here's the deal. There's a difference. Even if you were blind, an elephant would still look like an elephant. Am I right? Okay. So the fact that God describes himself as the invisible God does not mean that he therefore is absolutely devoid of any kind of... That it's wrong to describe him, or it's just allegorical to describe the fact that he has hair as white as wool and his garments are as white as snow. Okay? What it's saying is we can't see him there. Okay? Because you can look around and you can look on the sides of the north and you can look everywhere and you don't see him. Mankind is not able to see him. But I understand that this is a legitimate description of him. So as you're going through here, don't go, okay, so this is pretend. And so this is pretend, and so we're just, for our, you know, benefit, we're supposed to just sort of be pretending that this is what he looks like. No, actually, this is what he looks like. But he's invisible. We can't see him.
So,
okay?
Okay, I'm not going to ask that question. I saw the light, so.
Well, no, but on that, like, if nobody's ever seen God at any time, just a second, did you?
Yes.
You see God at any time, that is it because this is a vision, it was...
Correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
It
wasn't like he was actually standing before God at that minute. It was a vision. Was like,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's why there is that buffering capacity of it being described as a vision or a dream. Because no one can see God and...
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. Is there ever a time that you will see God?
Yes.
Yes. In your glorified body, you will be able to see God.
Are we talking about God the Father?
Yes, God the Father, you will be able to see him.
So, like, are we saying that God the Father has a body? Like the same way that Christ...
The same way as? No.
Okay.
But... it does still describe him in anthropomorphic terms.
Wow. Okay.
With eyes and hair and so forth. And we don't think that is just some sort of an accommodation to our silliness. He is the invisible God. There are going to be parts of this we completely don't understand, but these parts are true too.
Okay.
And on what level, I have no idea.
Yes.
So it's left deliberately with a high degree of mystery. Yes?
So we will be able to, but the angels cannot?
Angels can, yes.
So when their wings cover their eyes, why?
They're shielding their eyes, but it doesn't mean that they can't. In other passages, for example, in Matthew, it says, be careful not to offend one of these little ones, for their angels, their particular angels, continually face the throne of the Father in heaven.
Could they not face the throne and shield their eyes still?
What we do know is that the ones who are flying over top of him are shielding their eyes and they're shielding their face. But it does talk about angels beholding the face of. So, We have to taking the composite of all scripture. There is something that is able to be perceived visually by spiritual beings about God the Father. Is that as close as we can? I think that's as close as we can get. Okay? So, given that we're talking about the Father, here are a few little head-scratchers. Would someone turn to Mark chapter 9, verse 3, please?
And his garments, Mark 9, verse 3.
Or do the verse before that, I guess, if you would, please.
Okay, Mark 9, verse 2, it starts off. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and brought them up on a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his garments became radiant and exceedingly white, as no launderer on earth can whiten them.
Okay, go ahead, read on a little bit further.
Elijah appeared to them along with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah." For he did not know what to answer, for they became terrified. Then a cloud formed, overshadowing them, and a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." All at once, they looked around and saw no one with them anymore except Jesus alone.
Okay. Has anyone got in their Bible the companion reference for that in Luke? Where is that account in Luke?
9:28.
Yeah, let's go to Luke 9.
28-36.
Any ideas why he would be wanting to build three tabernacles?
One for the Lord, one for Moses, one for Elijah. To keep them in a container.
Okay.
Or to protect them.
Interesting idea. Any other ideas? That's a commonly taken one.
That's not right.
So, well, it might well be, but I'm going to suggest for your viewing pleasure something slightly different. Any other ideas that you have heard? See, Dwight was just recounting something that is commonly said there. So, what other idea? Why would he want to do three tents, tabernacles?
Does it have something to do with the Trinity?
That's an interesting idea.
That's not interesting.
Is that ever interesting? So what do you say when your little girl comes up to you and she's cooked something? You go, oh, is that ever interesting? No.
To make them stay?
To make them stay. That's the one that I heard most recently, yes. So that they would just kind of settle in and they could all just stay there for a while.
Can I throw out another one?
Sure. Try another
one. Is that something
one.
To do with the tabernacle of the, like, Holy of Holies and the mercy seat and... Like,
I think it does, yes.
All of that, I just don't...
Hospitality.
It's hospitality, because so they could have a potluck. Okay, let's start in verse 28. Some 8 days after these sayings...
Where?
In Luke 9, 28. He took along Peter and James and John and went up to the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face became different, and his clothing became white and gleaming. And behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses and Elijah, who, appearing in glory, and actually it's in appearing in their own personal glory, so that there was a brightness about them as well, were speaking of his departure. Very interesting, actually in the Greek, they were talking about his exodus. They were talking about his exodus, okay? Which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep, and when they were fully awake, they saw his glory, the two men standing with him. And so as he woke up, they were talking about his what?
Exodus.
What is the thing that you do if you are celebrating the Exodus?
Passover.
Passover?
Feast of Booths.
Tabernacle.
The Exodus where you're going off at. Yeah, the National Camping Week. So he's going, hey, we should be building booths.
Oh.
We should be building tents, tabernacles. So anyway, that's what I think is going on. Anyway. But I could be wrong on that one too. Okay, but anyway, there's a description of his appearance.
Can I say interesting?
Oh, that's very interesting. That is very interesting. Okay, well done. Let's go to Matthew chapter 28 and verse 3. Would someone read that for us, please?
And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing as white as snow.
Okay, who's it talking about? What is the antecedent of his?
Angel? Angel of the Lord? From the verse before?
Well, that's an angel of the Lord looks like that. Wow. Okay. Let's go to Revelation chapter 1. Would someone read verses 12 to 15, please?
Then I turned to see the voice that spoke with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the feet and girded about the chest with a golden band. His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes like a flame of fire. His feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters.
Okay, who's that describing?
Son of Man.
Someone who's the Son of Man. Well, who would we understand that as being?
Jesus
Christ.
By the way, that's something else that black Hebrew Israelites used to say Jesus is black. Like, his feet are like fine brass as refined in a furnace.
Yeah. But that's because they're thinking, oh, see, it's brass colored. But brass colored, when it is in its molten state, is what color?
Black.
Extremely bright, just hard to look at.
Well, fine in a furnace, it could be burned black.
No. Because if it's fine brass, it doesn't have anything that is oxidized.
Yeah.
It just becomes molten brass. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 6. In the year of Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, and with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his feet, and with two he covered his face, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." So we have several descriptions here of all of these persons that we've had described. What are some of the commonalities?
Very, very bright.
Very, very bright garments. Okay. What else?
White hair.
Yeah. Now, it doesn't say the angel had white hair, but it does say that the ones that are pretty identifiable as either God the Father or God the Son have white hair, like wool. Okay,
I mean,
so
I guess that's the glory about them. They have a glory.
Apparently, or yeah, there's just that kind of a white shining radiance. Okay, so people have gone here and they've said, okay, so this is Jesus Christ, and then the Son of Man comes up to him, and that because because in Revelation it's Jesus Christ, and Son of Man must be some sort of an angel or whatever. How do we navigate our way around that?
From Daniel 7, you mean?
Yeah.
On verse 13?
The whole passage, 9 to 14.
Well, there's two different people.
There has to be two different people, right? Yeah. And one is the Son of Man.
Right.
Okay? And so, just because the description in verse 9 sounds like the description in Revelation chapter 1, doesn't mean that they're the same person. It means they have some features that are somewhat similar. Okay? Which is sort of what you'd expect if they were God. Okay? That's where we're going with that. There appears to be something, a piece of commonality. Garments tend to be very, very white, and then there are further descriptors that seem to be exclusive of God. Especially this, fire was flowing and coming out from before him. You'd want to put in your margin there, Psalm 97. First two or three verses of Psalm 97 refer to that aspect of his throne. Its wheels. What is the... What wheels? Wheels of what?
Psalm 1.
Wheels of fire?
97. Its wheels. What is the word its referring back to?
Throne.
Throne. A throne had wheels.
Serious?
Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Wheels.
Where have you seen that before? This should be just jumping going, hey, wait a minute!
Ezekiel.
Ezekiel. Let's turn there. Ezekiel chapter 1.
Chapter what?
Ezekiel chapter 1. How much before Daniel wrote here in Daniel 7 was Ezekiel chapter 1 written? Not that long. Ezekiel wrote this as a young man, and he was a contemporary of Daniel. So this would have been maybe at most a few decades, but basically the same generation. But a little earlier.
Ezekiel was earlier?
Ezekiel was written earlier. Let's pick it up in verse 4. As I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually, and a bright light around it, and in its midst something like glowing metal in the midst of the fire. Within it were four figures resembling four living beings, and this was their appearance. They had human form. Each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides were human hands. As for the faces and the wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another. Their faces did not turn when they moved. Each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each had the face of a man. All four had the face of a lion on the right and the face of a bull on the left, and all four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each had two touching another being and two covering their bodies. And each went straight forward, wherever the spirit was about to go. They would go without turning as they went. In the midst of the beings, living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright and lightning was flashing from the fire. And the living beings ran to and fro like lightning bolts. Now as I looked at the living beings, behold, there was one wheel on the earth beside the living beings for each of the four of them. In other words, on the four corners there are four wheels. The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl, and all four of them had the same form, their appearance and their workmanship being as if one wheel were within another. Whenever they moved in any of their four directions without turning as they moved. As for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all four of them were full of full of eyes round about. Wherever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them. And wherever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. Wherever the spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction. And the wheels rose beside them, for the spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. Wherever they went, these went, and wherever they stood still, they stood still. And wherever they rose from the earth, the wheels rose close beside them, for the spirit of the living being was in the wheels. That is the mobile, moving chair throne of God being described.
So would that be the Holy Spirit as the wheels, or no?
We aren't told. But whoever it is, it's God who's doing that.
It's cool.
But that is a mobile throne room that is being thrown, that is being suspended and moving all about, being held up on four corners by four living beings that don't have to turn their head when they go this way because they've got a face on that side.
Wow.
And you go, that sounds a little bit strange. And you go, yeah, it does.
It sure does.
Yeah, it does. And out the back side, it's eagles. This side, it's men. Go, wow, what in the world? What in the world? And we go, why would God make beings that look like people or animals on the earth? Of course, that's the wrong question. What is the right question?
Anthropomorphic.
What does that mean again?
Anthropomorphism. Yes.
Anthropomorphism.
Okay, so my first question was, why would God make these creatures to look like creatures that were on the earth? And I said, that's the wrong question. What is the right question? Or the other way around, why would he make creatures on the earth to resemble the ones in heaven? That's right. So these ones that we have on the earth, there's shades and there's shadows of something that already existed, was already in existence in heaven.
Oh,
by the way, just so that you know, when it talks about in Revelation chapter 4, and boy, we're running out of time.
We're
done an hour. When it talks in Revelation chapter 4 about the living creatures that are around the throne, every other place in Scripture, that term, living creature, is translated what? Animals. It's just translated animals. But the translators came across that and they said, oh, animals, and they were starting to translate it, but then very soon the animals spoke and they go, okay, so that wouldn't work. But we don't know that that isn't what originally worked. We don't know that the original creation in the Garden of Eden wasn't that animals had the power of speech. That's possible. And that they lost it in the fall. We don't know that. Because for one thing, Eve, she's considering the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and a snake comes along and starts talking to her, and she goes, Adam, get me out of here, there's a talking snake. Okay, doesn't do that. Well, didn't surprise, you know, react with a lot of surprise. So anyway,
so there,
just a thing to think about.
There's obviously probably creatures like that that eternally existed in heaven. Not eternally, but were created. But
yeah, we know that there's going to be horses, for example. They come riding on horses.
Yeah.
So, but the idea of, oh, okay, so, you know, when I get to heaven, I want a platypus without the little spurs. No. Those creatures are part of this creation, and that creation is going to be passing away. But apparently, there are elements that will be recognizable from the animal kingdom in heaven. Yes?
I was going to say, well, we know that you can give voice to an animal because of Balaam's donkey.
You're very right. Exactly right. Yes. So, that is still quite possible. Anyway, okay, so let's go back to Daniel chapter
7.
Yes.
So this passage about the throne, like, is it common for people to spiritualize that?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much. Yes. And see, here's the problem. When you start a passage like that and you go, okay, so first off, it sounds like nonsense to me, and it doesn't make any sense, so I'm going to allegorize it. By what rule, then, do you look at that passage and get a stable platform of truth? You don't have anything.
I can't. Yeah.
You can't. Because you could say, I think it has something to do with bullfrogs. And you can't say it's wrong. Or you could say, I think it has something to do with my Aunt Velma's pickled beets. And you can't say that's wrong. Because if it's allegory, your idea is as good as mine, right? And the more creative, the better. The only way that you have a stable platform where a stable platform of epistemology, your understanding of truth, is you say, I don't quite know how to picture that, but there's some descriptors in there that I'm supposed to be trying to wrap my mind around. And when I see it, I'll be going, okay, yeah, no, that's what he meant. Okay? But it isn't an invitation to just automatically jettison the literal. Okay? We're never given that. Okay? When you do have the permission to jettison the literal is when he says, and I saw another beast come up, and it had four heads and so forth. And afterward, in the comments section of that chapter, it says, oh, and by the way, that beast is Greece. And the four heads are four generals, which he does. Okay? So you're given the permission to do that, and you're given the key to do that. And if you're not given the key and all that, then take it as something that is straight up.
Yeah, like the statue in Daniel's vision, like,
right,
the head of gold, that's allegorical.
It is. Right. It was part of his, he's describing what was in the vision.
Yeah.
What did that mean? Okay. Then we're given the key to understand what the components,
yeah,
the elements are. It was actually a real vision he had.
Yeah.
Okay. It wasn't an allegorical vision, and actually it was an octopus. It was an image of a man,
yeah,
but that was what the correspondent. He'll tell you what the correspondence was.
Okay.
But so, even when you see a passage that is seemingly as bizarre as Ezekiel chapter 1, that's not an invitation to just go, okay, well, flight of fancy. You know, let's say that one. Let's say, for example, the thing, you know, with the hooded beak there. Maybe that's an Apache attack helicopter. Yeah. No, you're not allowed to do that. Okay.
So
yes.
Then with that question, and you could answer, what do we do then with that? Where do we start looking to expand on what maybe that is? Do we just start cross-referencing? How would we know? Like, so we come across Ezekiel, where someone says, "Hey, I was just flipping through the Bible, and I come across Ezekiel, and man, that sounds like it's them Apache helicopters, and they're building a whole whack of them."
Yeah, right.
You know, so the end is coming near, and then,
yeah,
how would we say, well, no, let's...
Let's go back. We go, let's say, well, what is in the text?
Yeah.
Okay? And you find out that somebody's sitting on this thing that's
right,
going all over the place. And then you cross-reference, you find, well, look at here, Jiminy Cricket, Daniel chapter 6. It's talking about some thrones were set up, and look at that. They got wheels of burning fire under them.
Okay, so that's... So
okay, so this is a component of the throne of God.
Mm-hmm. Could...
And the reason why it would have wheels on it is because... It eats maple syrup. No, because it's moving, okay? Because it's able to... It's mobile. Okay?
But he could move it without...
Yes, he could. But apparently he wants to do it within the correspondence of wheels.
Okay. But could there be a chance that, or I don't actually believe this, but I'm kind of curious about this. Could there be some...
This is going to be good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
could,
okay.
I think I'm a theologian.
Oh, yeah.
Could there be some allegorical passages in this talking about the end times that we don't have a meaning for yet, but Christ will reveal when he comes?
Here's the deal. the whole reason why he gives revelation is so that we would know and not be ignorant. Okay? And he will give you he will talk about a vision. For example, the vision of that statue. But the whole point of that is not to then begin to speculate. Okay, so was the statue holding a sword or wasn't it? Obviously, those points are irrelevant. They're not part of the things that we need to know. They weren't part of the thing that God was wanting to inform us about. And so there is a great danger in looking past, like for example, in this passage here, he's talking about these four beasts. Verse 17 then, these great beasts which are four in number are four kings who will arise from the earth. Okay, that's what he wanted us to get out of that, okay? And it's not then we do some sort of an extended study on the difference between lions and leopards. The caloric consumption between a lion and a leopard, those aren't important details. The important details are the ones that are expounded on. And the rest of them, if you begin to speculate past that, you are, again, entering into basically mysticism.
Yeah.
So I would say don't speculate, again, don't speculate past revelation. Just, we got lots to deal with just dealing with the revelation that's here, right? Rather than going and speculating. Okay, let's keep on going. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. And again, that's descriptive in Psalm 97 about his throne. Thousands upon thousands were attending him. And the word there, attending, mean in continual, consistent service. And if you wanted to, you could put beside that Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 3. And that is exactly the scene that we see described for us in Revelation chapter 5, verse 11. And it even uses the same terms, myriads upon myriads, which was the Greek term for either 10,000 or, if it's used in that context, means innumerable times innumerable. Okay? Infinity times infinity is the idea. An extremely large number. They were standing before him. And it says, there the court sat and the books were opened. In the meantime, while that's happening, verse 11, then I kept looking. So he's doing timelining it here. That's chronological movement. He kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. And we'll talk a little bit more about that and the significance of it, but we'll deal with this part first. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Where have we seen a concept like that before? Daniel chapter 2, right?
Yeah.
That's the destruction of Rome. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted them for an appointed period of time. They kind of got the Babylon got kind of folded into the next one, Medo-Persia. It was a major province in Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia became a factor into the Greece. Greece, the entirety of its empire, was a portion of Rome. So there was a sense in which that empire had some longevity. It continued in a form in the next one. But when it comes to this beast, it was utterly destroyed and given to the burning fire. So that was the end of then all of them at the same time. All right, so verse 13, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the cloud of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, and all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Over and over again in this passage, there is a progression along in terms of chronology. This is a progress of time. What happens before the Son of Man is given a kingdom? What event precedes that?
The rapture?
Yes, you were quite right. But you didn't get from that passage, but you are right anyway. Right. What else? What from this passage? Before he receives a kingdom and establishes a kingdom, what happens immediately preceding that?
Tears it down? Tears down the old one?
This complete destruction of the fourth beast. You're right.
That'd be okay. Verse 11?
Yes. So the fourth beast needs to be utterly destroyed, and then his kingdom is set up. Okay? So just again to make sure that we're tracking here. The church began when?
Pentecost.
And when Pentecost took place, the Roman Empire was suddenly, dramatically shattered and came to a complete end, right?
It almost ramped up.
Yes, it did. That's right. So did the church utterly smash Rome so that there was nothing left of it for any generation in all of time and eternity? When the church was set up in Pentecost, did that immediately inaugurate a golden kingdom where all peoples, nations, and tongues immediately began to serve the God of heaven? No, they persecuted Christians. Yeah. It was game on and war, okay? So this can't be something making reference to what happened at Pentecost, because my goodness, at Pentecost, there was nothing of the Roman Empire destroyed. Okay? And as we go into the passage here, we're going to see why that is, because he's going to give some refinements about what the nature of Rome is going to be. Yes, you were.
And there's no way that it can be at the point of the cross either here, right?
No. No.
Because, okay.
You're right. It can't be the cross. It can't be Pentecost. It can't be... See, here's why this is important to know.
Okay.
Because there are people who later on, as they began to allegorize, they said, you know something? That was us. That's the church. We're supposed to be absolutely dominating the world. And so they put together the idea of Christianity and kingdom, and they came up with what word?
Christendom,
where the Pope was supposed to be ruling over the entire world. And he was, because he was, it talks about Christ coming and slaying the wicked with the word of his mouth, and there being great violence and so forth. They said, hey, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And that was what gave rise to what?
Crusades,
right? Because they thought that, but over and over again here, is this where the saints decide to all pick up swords and go bonking all the unsaved on the head? No. Okay, who is it that utterly smashes the fourth kingdom? It is Christ himself, okay? And the other thing, just a little bit of a thing here before, so we close. When Christ was giving the Olivet Discourse, why don't we turn there for really quickly. Let's go to Matthew chapter 23. We'll just look at a few verses and we'll deal with this in greater depth in our next time together. Matthew 23 and verse, my Henry, let's start at verse 31. Okay, I'm the last guy there. Okay. Nope, that wasn't the right one. I am so sorry. 24, 30. There you go. Sorry, I wrote the wrong one down. 24, 30. Okay. He's talking, let's go back here, verse 24. For the false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. So if they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. Or behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Okay, so first of all, what elements should we discern are going to be visible about the coming of the Son of Man? How does that correspond to lightning? It is comparable to lightning in what way?
It's quick.
Oh. It's quick. What else?
You'll see it from east to west.
Wow.
Yes, it is spellbinding. What else?
It's visible to all.
Yeah. It's not one of those things like, well, I wonder, would that have been lightning or would that have been figurative lightning? Everyone goes, you can either, right? Huge, and it goes right across the sky. Everyone goes, yeah, no, that was lightning. Okay. No, no contest. Nobody's wondering, well, I wonder if that was the coming or not, right? Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Okay, that was lightning. The Son of Man is going to be desperately, desperately obvious. It is not going to be mysterious where people are wondering, well, was it or was it not? Okay? And so if there's a group of people going and saying, well, so the coming of the Son of Man, what is that possible that that really did take place, as the Jehovah's Witness say, in 1917? Well, did everybody on the entire earth go, oh, that was the coming of the Son of Man? No. Okay? So, and the next thing is verse 28, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. What's that making reference to? Coming of the Son of Man is going to involve what? Everyone going, oh, hooray! Isn't this awesome?
Or
no, it's going to be a place of massive of destruction. Okay, there's going to be corpses. Now that's talking about the tribulation, verse 29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, so this is after the tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. He's going to be coming on what? What do we have back here? It talks about here in verse 13 of Daniel 7. Behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man coming. What is Jesus teaching about? He's giving you further teaching on the timing of Daniel chapter 7. Okay? He's saying that there's going to be a great big period of time. Nations are going to rise against nations. There's going to be war all over the place. There's going to be earthquakes and all kinds of things. And after the great tribulation, then the Son of Man will come on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory, and he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Did that happen at the cross? Or at Pentecost? This is future. So what is Daniel chapter 7? It's future. It has to be yet future for us. Jesus even referred to it as future. If you scoot ahead to Matthew chapter 25, verse 31. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. There's a whole bunch of things he's doing here. He's making reference to Son of Man sitting on a throne, and he is coming and getting his kingdom. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, and he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. Okay? We'll talk about that more next time, but that's a direct reference to Joel and so forth. Let's scoot ahead to Matthew 26, verse 60-something. Let's start in verse 62. The high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Is that something that's connected with his first coming? No, it's not. It has to be something that's future. So, we've established something here. Daniel chapter 7 is something that Christ described as yet future. And the interesting thing is, as we go and we talk about the little horn that starts speaking great, boastful words, Paul makes reference to that and talks about that being yet future for us. Okay, so thus we'll take it thus far. Any questions about what we've handled so far? Well, I want you to get the fact that Jesus describes the Son of Man coming on the clouds. Just the fact that he says, I'm going to be coming on the clouds, means that by inference he has before that, if he's going to be coming, he had to, for a while, leave. Which is the period we're in right now. Okay? Has Christ come back, as described, with all of his angels, gathering all of the elect, you know, such a way that everybody understands it, coming with the clouds of heaven? No. Okay? So this is all yet future for us. Okay? We're going to find some more details about it as we tackle the last part of this chapter. But if you gather this much together, you have already now described yourself as something. If you understand that first there are these kingdoms, and then Christ smashes the kingdoms and sets up his kingdom in theology, at that point you are what? Premillennial. Okay? And that's the thing. That's why people who study this, they will say, isn't this crazy? Daniel seems to be believing that it's premillennial. Isn't that weird how mixed up he was? Or they try and, you know, get some sort of a figurative understanding out of it. But it really is teaching premillennialism. Okay.
So it didn't just come in with...
It didn't start in 1850. Yeah. No. Okay. No, it didn't.
Schofield.
Yeah, they didn't start with Schofield's notes.
Okay.
No. Yeah, no. It didn't come.